Some big surprises in last night's primary. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. In the race for governor, there was a landslide and a nail-biter. Now we have Ron DeSantis versus Andrew Gillum in the race for Florida's top office. We're going to talk with Jim DeFede of CBS 4. Plus, South Florida is not just facing a crisis in the lack of affordable housing. There's a segment of the population struggling to find livable and safe housing. But what does the law say about the living conditions for those who live on the fringes of society? Also, there's a big vote tomorrow in Miami on the future of public transit. We're going to hear from the former mayor who championed a tax in 2002 for more rail. And finally, it's tough trying to make it as an artist, but there's a new program in Palm Beach County providing a place for artists to get free supplies, classes, and even learn how to run their own business. We're going to learn about Studio 411. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, if you didn't follow the vote tallies last night, you probably woke up today surprised at the final results. In the hotly fought gubernatorial primary, GOP candidate Ron DeSantis won in a landslide, and Andrew Gillum surged in the final hours to win the Democratic ticket. This year's primary also saw a larger turnout than usual for a midterm. So let's talk about what happened last night. We're joined by CBS4's Jim DeFede, host of Facing South Florida. We're going to talk about all about last night and what to expect before the general election. Jim, always a pleasure.
Louis, thanks for having me. I've got my coffee, so let's go.
I don't have coffee. I got my tea. I'm good. All right, let's start by taking a look at the major upset in the Democratic primary. Polls had Gwen Graham with a strong lead over Andrew Gillum and Philip Levine. Do we have a sense of what gave Gillum the final edge at the end?
Yeah, I think there were a few factors. One, you know, again, yet again, we're realizing you can't trust polling. Polling is highly inaccurate. But I think there were several reasons why Andrew Gillum won this race. And I think the first is, this became a battleground for progressives across the country. They've been willing to prove that a progressive candidate can win. They see this as a microcosm of 2018 of what can happen in 2020. So they are using Florida's a proving ground. As a result, you had Bernie Sanders come down and campaign for Gillum. You had George Soros and Tom Steyer pony up big money to help Gillum maintain some sort of semblance in this race and make a final push with TV advertising in South Florida. But another factor that I thought was critical is you saw no negative ads run against Andrew Gillum. You had every other candidate bashing each other on TV, you know, whether it was Levine attacking Green, Green attacking Graham, on back and forth, but nobody took a punch at Gillum. And I think for two reasons. One, the polls had Gillum in fourth place, so you don't want to waste your money punching down. But two, and perhaps more importantly, none of the candidates wanted to be seen as attacking an African-American candidate.
And
as a result, you know, they wanted to be able to look forward to November and not turn off African-American voters, so they went ahead and laid kid gloves off him, and in hindsight, that was their downfall.
And we talk about negative ads, not to say it was an ad, but, well, something was said already before the general election. I'll get to that in a second. On the Republican side, Ron DeSantis easily took the victory over Adam Putnam. Again, polls showed it was a lot tighter race, but, I mean, really a landslide. Where were the fundamental issues within Putnam's campaign? I mean, you know, what did he miss on this? Or was it just kind of a foregone conclusion that Trump supporters were going to give DeSantis the win?
So on the downside of what Adam Putnam did wrong, Adam Putnam was essentially trying to run a campaign that says, I'm Florida first, you know, I'm a good, competent leader. I'm the heir apparent. I'm the establishment candidate. Establishment candidates do not fare well anymore in the Republican Party. The other problem, too, was his mishandling of the concealed weapons permits and the process that went through sort of betrayed the notion that he was a good, competent leader who could manage and run the state. But set all that aside, the reality is the second Donald Trump tweeted his support for Ron DeSantis, this race changed. The Florida GOP primary voter is a Trump voter. And so once he did his thing by tweeting in support of DeSantis, you had two things immediately happen. One, national fundraising came in a big way for DeSantis. And two, the foot soldiers in the GOP that love Donald Trump and believe that Ron DeSantis has had Donald Trump's back in Congress, they see him on Fox News, they were going to turn out for him. Donald Trump made the difference. He takes credit for it. He deserves the credit for it. And that's what they got, and this is Trump's party now in Florida.
And we talk about controversy. It's already started. Congressman DeSantis was on Fox News this morning talking about his challenger in the general election, Andrew Gillum, and his comments already stirring the controversy. Let's listen.
You know, I watched those Democrat debates. None of that was my cup of tea. But, I mean, he performed better than the other people there. So we've got to work hard to make sure that we continue Florida going in a good direction. Let's build off the success we've had on Governor Scott. The last thing we need to do is to monkey this up by trying to embrace a socialist agenda with huge tax increases and bankrupting the state. That is not going to work. That's not going to be good for Florida. So I'm going to fight for what I believe in.
Okay. Defeaty, what in the world do you expect to see in the next few months?
Well, if this is what the first 24 hours are like, we can only imagine what the next 10 weeks are going to be like. Look, this is going to be a hypersensitive race. You're going to see race as an issue. You're going to see a lot of issues being raised, a lot of name-calling back and forth. This is going to be down and dirty because there is so much at stake. What I referred to before, a microcosm of what's happening in 2018 being a harbinger of things to come in 2020. So you're going to see a lot of national figures coming on both sides fighting this race. And the other point that I don't think gets made often enough is whoever is the governor elected this time around will be the governor in 2020 when the state's congressional districts are being redrawn. While the legislature does the redrawing, the governor has the ability to veto. Having a Democrat in the Tallahassee governor's mansion would be critical for Democrats to win back some for additional congressional seats when the lines are redrawn. So there's a lot at stake here.
What were some of the other big surprises from yesterday's primary?
Well, I think that if you go and you look at Congressional District 27, I think a lot of people thought that Donna Shalala would win much more handily than she did. She's very fortunate right now. I mean, if Matt Hagman had not been in this race, David Richardson would be the nominee. And I think you could almost make the reverse. If David Richardson had been out of this race, Matt Hagman would be the nominee. Donna Shalala showed herself to be a weak candidate this time around. Now, she's going to have to work a lot harder. She's going to have to be a lot smarter. Democrats still have the advantage, but not as great an advantage as you would think. If you look at the raw vote totals, there were 44,000 votes cast in that district in the primary for Democrats. There were 39,000 votes cast for Republicans. That's a pretty good advantage for Democrats, but it's not a slam dunk that everyone's been assuming it is. I think that race could get really interesting. When it's a generic D versus a generic R, the D wins easily. The problem is Donna Shalala is not a generic D. She carries the Clinton baggage with her. Her age is going to be an issue that some people are going to look at. I think that there's a number of things that the Republicans, if they have the time, money, and resources to run against her, could hurt her on. It's still favored to be a Democratic pickup, but we're going to have to wait and see.
All right, real quickly, turnout was better than we've seen in usual midterms, but what do you attribute to the voters' interest in this midterm?
I think because of what is at stake. I think this is the most consequential midterm election probably of my lifetime, and I think voters are feeling it both on the Republican and Democratic side. You saw, for instance, in Dade County, I think the vote was up about 72% over 4 years ago, the last midterm election. Among Republicans, it was up over 30%. Normally, Republicans would be dancing in the streets at a 30% increase in turnout from 4 years ago, until you look across the way at the Democrats and what they did. I think it's going to continue to be this way. Look, going back to the governor's race real briefly, when you look at how that race is going to play out, I don't think it's going to be a fight for the center, as everyone keeps talking about. I don't think it's about whether or not Ron DeSantis can get swing voters or Andrew Gillum can get swing voters. I think this is a base election year. I think the Democrats' calculation is that we've been nominating moderates for the last five governor's races and losing every time. What we need instead is, the Democrats believe, is a progressive candidate who will increase their numbers, bring new voters to the polls. And I think on the Republican side, Ron DeSantis feels the same way. He wants to get his voters out, try to go keep that Trump coalition together that won Florida in 2016. But you're going to see a fight to both parties' extreme ends.
That's interesting. Not a fight for the middle. Let's push off to the right and left. Real quickly, we'll finish on this. Many were calling 2018 the year of the woman in politics. How does that play out so far?
Well, Gwen and the men turn out to be the men. So it was not a good year for women in that regard. But look in the congressional races, you have three women running in competitive races, four women actually running in competitive races in the congressional district. You got Donna Shalala versus Maria Elvira Salazar for Congressional District 27 to replace Ileana. You've got Debbie Mercalso Powell running against Carlos Curbelo, and you've got Mary Barzee Flores running against Lincoln Diaz-Balart. So women are still a major factor up and down the ticket. We'll see whether or not this turns out to be the year of the woman. We'll know that in November.
We've been talking with CBS4's Jim DeFede, host of Facing South Florida, talking about last night's primary and where we go from here. Jim, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lewis.
All right, still to come, a closer look at the part of our population desperate for safe housing. That's up coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, before we return to the show, I just want to tell you that we do have a big announcement to make at the end of today's program, so please stick around for that. Moving on, though, the story of affordable housing is a common headline in South Florida. There isn't enough of it, but for the affordable housing that does exist, what are the conditions of these properties? Is it quality and safe affordable housing? WLRN's Nadesh Green recently reported a story about the conditions at Stony Brook Apartments in Riviera Beach, where some of the units were unlivable because of mold. And the Miami Herald's Joey Fletch has reported on public housing units in that they had no air conditioning. We're joined now by Nadesh and Joey in the downtown studios. Nadesh, Joey, such a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Both of your stories touch on how people's health can be affected by the conditions of where they live. But what surprised both of you most as you went into these buildings? I mean, tell me about what you were seeing and experiencing, Nadesh.
I don't think much surprised me because this isn't the first time I've seen this in low-income housing here in South Florida. I mean, some of what I saw, like at Stony Brook, for example, where you actually can't see the mold, right? But you could see all of the units that had been condemned by the city because of issues with mold. They had an environmental report, and the tenants themselves had an environmental report done on some of the apartments that confirmed very high level of mold. You had children, many children on nebulizer machines, kids with asthma there who've been complaining of breathing problems. And it's not just at Stony Brook. Across South Florida, this is an issue where low-income housing means poor people are also living in substandard conditions. And we often don't talk about the quality of the housing because it's like, look, they're lucky they have somewhere to live, but we don't consider how people are living.
Yeah, Joey, for you, I was blown away, but maybe my naivete, I just thought you live in South Florida. I mean, AC is just, you have to have it. It's a requirement, but you're finding their public housing without it?
That was my same reaction. I found out about this actually through a press release that was pushed out by the city of Miami. They were promoting the fact that they had donated some money to the county to buy air conditioning units for some housing in Liberty Square. And when I read that, I said, wait, they don't already have air conditioning. There are units that still don't have air conditioning. And as I only took a couple of questions to figure out that it's not required. It's not required by the federal government. And interestingly enough, in a place like Liberty Square that was built in the 30s, and it was built under Washington-centric rules for public housing, they all have heaters, which might, again, cause you to scratch your head here in Florida, South Florida. They all have heaters, but they don't have air conditioning. They've never been retrofitted. It's never been part of their funding formula.
Does the county know what public housing units don't have air conditioning? Are we tracking that data?
I don't believe that's being tracked. When I asked for that information, their response was because they allow people to purchase their own. That is the solution, the only solution on the table for the problem for people is they have to save up and buy their own AC, which again, this is public housing and it makes you wonder that has to be part of your calculation if you want to live in it. It's another burden, but that is something that they can't track pretty much. The number of AC units that have been purchased and installed. And then furthermore, the ones that are still working and not working because they can break down. Obviously, we all know that. We've all been through that. But again, it's more of a burden when someone in public housing's air conditioning breaks down than it is for perhaps you or I. Mm. So they don't have that information.
Nadezh, remind us again, and we heard this, your story on Morning Edition and All Things Considered within the last week, but remind us again about Stony Brook Apartments.
So the Stony Brook Apartments in Riviera Beach, I mean, the issues at Stony Brook are not new. They've been reported on and reported on and reported on. The only thing that is consistent is that nothing really has changed. So Stony Brook is an apartment complex, a privately owned apartment complex that receives federal subsidies. It was owned by Global Ministries Foundation. In fact, GMF still owns it, but they're in the process of trying to sell it to a new company called Millennia Housing. Global Ministries Foundation, the current owner, has been under fire for a number of serious issues, including unsafe living conditions in many of its properties, which is why it's being forced really to sell it. And the new potential owner, also currently the property manager, Millennia Housing, is to plans on purchasing it and rehabbing it, according to what they've submitted to the city of Riviera Beach.
What does that mean, rehabbing?
Completely fixing up all of the apartments. But in the interim, the tenants say it's still not livable. Like, we can't wait for you to figure out who is going to buy it or not buy it. And you're still living in these conditions. And we're talking about not just mold, but confirmed asbestos, and which typically isn't a general health hazard unless it's disturbed. City records show that it has been disturbed where there's been construction where asbestos is, and floors have been broken up. And so there are some very real concerns for the tenants about their health conditions. And it's not just them. City officials have expressed concerns about children, people with low immune systems who are affected by living under these conditions.
This is where the tenants actually stood up to the landlord and said, we've had enough. And they're actually trying to take legal action.
Right. The tenants formed a tenant union at Stony Brook, and they have an attorney who is representing them. They filed a lawsuit against the city, the owner, HUD, which provides federal subsidies for this property, saying that you have a responsibility to fix these issues. Tenants have basic rights that are not being met here.
Yeah. What does the law say about tenants' rights, whether it's public housing or anything? I mean, what tenants have rights, right?
Tenants have rights, but when you're poor, exercising those rights or actually having someone do right by you can be very costly, right? A legal challenge, mounting a legal challenge around something like mold in public housing is very expensive. And so if you don't have a pro bono attorney to represent you, then how do you fight the landlord? I mean, one of the things even the city mayor mentioned is that even when the city does enforce its code enforcement laws, for example, and they go in and they fine the owner pays the fine, but doesn't necessarily fix the problem. It's actually cheaper to pay the code enforcement fine to the city than it is to fix the underlying issue here.
Joey, yeah. I mean, do tenants in public housing, I mean, do tenant rights also apply to them? Or is it, as Nadezh said, well, you know, if you can find somebody who's going to fight for you?
I mean, you have those rights. It's not like you don't have different rights because you're a public housing tenant versus, right, you know, a tenant who does not receive federal subsidies. It's a matter of now getting someone to enforce that, right? Getting,
right,
you know, Miami-Dade County to, if it, that is your landlord, to actually do something about a particular issue, or if it's a private landlord, to get landlords to do something. I think nationally, like when landlords take tenants to court, 90% of the time, the landlord has an attorney, but the tenant does not, mm-hmm, because it's expensive.
So the city has donated AC units, some units, mm-hmm, I think like 50 plus units, to this particular area, but that's not enough. But I mean, did somebody speak up and that's why they're doing it?
It was actually something that was recognized at a site visit from city administrators, because Liberty Square is actually currently under a redevelopment, and the new development will have air conditioning. That is the policy of the county, that when they go in and they rebuild public housing, they add AC. But over the next 5 years, it will be completely rebuilt with air conditioning. But in the meantime, there was a site visit and an administrator said, wait a minute, why isn't there AC? Why is it so hot in here? And then it was explained. They went and they found some money and they gave it to the county to install them. But that, you know, again, that was sort of a small moment that I think illuminated a problem that most people don't know about.
As you pointed out, we come back to it. There's no law that says they have to provide
AC.
That's
correct. Yeah.
Again, I'm talking with reporters WLRN reporter Nadezh Green and the Miami Herald's Joey Fletches, and they both looked at different low-income housing complexes in Miami-Dade and Palm Beach counties and reported health concerns from tenants who say their homes are making them sick, whether it's because of mold or their public housing units with no air conditioning, living in South Florida without that. You can read their stories, by the way, on our website, WLRN.org. Nadege, so we come back because you went in there, and again, you don't always see mold, but you talked to one mother, and she was telling you about how her daughter was just constantly getting sick. What else did you hear from tenants about, I guess, how living in this apartment complex was making them ill?
It was very interesting because the tenants, you know, you don't always know your neighbors, but when they started this tenant union, they started going door to door talking to their neighbors, and we're talking about the Stony Brook Apartments in Riviera Beach here. And what they found was so many of their neighbors also had children who had nebulizers, you know, the breathing machines that, you know, give you the steroids to help you breathe better. Or so many of the kids either already had asthma and it was exacerbated or had multiple trips to the ER or to the doctor because of breathing issues.
And you talked to, it was the woman that I mentioned, her name is Edna House, and her daughter, again, dealing with these symptoms. And here's a little piece of what she said.
She kept having problems with her eyes. And just all the mucus that was always in her throat and stuff. A lot of kids here do respiratory treatments, and I didn't even realize that until we started going door for door.
All right, so I mean, you know what? I mean, she has to get treatment for her daughter, and that's an extra cost that's added on top of that. Have people said anything about just leaving, or is that even an option?
You know, I think it was a James Baldwin quote that says, it's very expensive to be poor, right? You can't just pick up and go, right? You can't just, because you're in low-income housing for a reason, because you can't afford market-rate housing. First month, last month deposit, even in a fairly affordable place, is going to set you back at least $1,800. They don't have that. And so in the interim, if you can't just pick up and leave, the owner of the property has to do right. That is the landlord. And if the landlord does not do right, you are stuck in this position where you know that this situation isn't good for your health, but you have nowhere else to go. And when we talk about affordable housing in Miami-Dade County, we always talk about quantity, but quality matters. Where someone lives matters, their health outcome matters. We're talking about children, and more often than not, people in low-income housing are women with young children or the elderly.
You know, the other thing I'm still stuck on is, again, that they're trying to sell this property to another company, that company wants to rehab it, but I know that you've also told me about it. I don't know if this also applies, is that, you know, property in South Florida is just very, very valuable, and some landlords may see great opportunity. Is there any fear that, you know, this new owner would say, you know what, there's a great opportunity here, clean it out and build something else?
Not necessarily at this property, because again, it is HUD subsidized. And so that is a more difficult process. It's not privately owned and unsubsidized. If it was an unsubsidized property, then yes, that could be a very real concern. Mm. But because they receive federal subsidies, it will remain as low income housing even after the rehab.
Do we know, by the way, this legal action that they're taking, how that impacts the sale of this property?
That is a good question. So there will be a vote on whether or not the city is going to accept the plan to rehab this property. That has to go through the city. They also have to pay some $300,000 in code enforcement violations before they can get a clear title to purchase this property. And that is supposed to happen September 5th when the Riviera Beach City Council will vote on that part of it. But again, the tenants at Stony Brook are saying, in spite of the cell and all of this stuff, what we're asking for is safe, livable conditions, even in the interim, that we have a right to that.
And as you said, too, at the beginning, is that this is not unique. We see this happening in a lot of other places. But do tenants know that they could possibly come together the way the people at Stony Brook did? I mean, is that even a conversation people have to fight back to try to get conditions improved?
I think you're starting to see more of that, but the reality of it is you need time to do that. So if you have a full-time job or a part-time job and you have kids to take to school, you need to do all of these other things as well. And now all of a sudden you have to become almost a full-time advocate just to have city government listen to you, or to have a landlord listen to you, or to find an attorney that might represent you, because we don't have like housing court here in South Florida. And like in some other states, there's housing court where you can take these issues. Then that takes time to show up to court and do all of these things. And so I think it's a challenge, and you're seeing more tenants organize, because as we get more renters, people are going to start holding landlords more accountable.
Joey, we think about, dealing with this issue right now of public housing units with no AC and how people are trying to survive. And, you know, on top of that, big picture, you know, when you look at the meta, is this idea that, well, you know, as climate changes and the temperatures get, every summer we keep hearing this is the hottest year on record, and it gets worse and worse and worse. I mean, that just kind of multiplies these people's problems.
the issue of climate change is often it's often creating images in our heads of flooding, of bad hurricanes, bad storms. But the reality is, its simplest facet, the heat itself, is going to be a huge public health issue. And who's the most vulnerable in a public health crisis? The poor, the people, the disadvantaged. And so in public housing, yes, it might not be a problem this summer, next summer, 2 summers from now, but let's talk about, the units that are going to be left over that haven't been redeveloped 4 or 5 years from now, when it's just markedly hotter and our heat waves are spiking even further into the triple digits, and then we have heat-related deaths, then we have more asthma, we have all of this cascading impact on public health. And that's something that I think people might not necessarily be thinking about when they think of climate change. That's sort of the tangential issue.
It's not just the rising seas. There's a lot more.
Is part of the resilient cities.
It's really an ecosystem we live in, right? And so that part of that ecosystem, just being able to cool your living space so that you can live properly, you can live healthily, that's going to be significant.
Two incredible stories to believe, but two amazing stories. Again, talking with WLRN's Nadesh Green and the Miami Herald's Joey Fletches. Again, their stories, you could find it at WLRN.org. Nadesh, Joey, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
All right, still to come, there's a big vote tomorrow in the future of transit in Miami. We're going to talk with the former mayor who fought for the tax that he believes has been misused. That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. All right, so the Miami-Dade County Commission is set to vote tomorrow on the future of public transit in the county's southern corridor. The vote will determine whether to allocate funding from the People's Transportation Plan, that's a fund supported by a half-cent tax passed by voters in 2002, towards bus rapid transit or the expansion of Metro Rail. Alex Pinellas was mayor of Miami-Dade in 2002 and was a champion of the PTP. In a recent op-ed for the Miami Herald, Pinellas argued this funding was specifically designated for Metro Rail expansion and has been regularly diverted for existing transit over the last 16 years. There's also a wrinkle in tomorrow's vote. The Citizens Independent Transportation Trust, for the first time since being established in 2002, says it will forbid the use of funds from the PTP for subsidizing maintenance of current transit. So it follows a lawsuit from Commissioner Xavier Suarez, who says the subsidies are a violation of the agreement passed by the voters. So former Mayor Pinellas joins us now in studio. Mayor Pinellas, thanks so much. I really appreciate the time.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
This is a big topic. We've had a lot of people on the show talking about this. So take us real quickly back to 2002 when the half-cent tax was passed by voters. What was the appetite back then for public transit? What were people talking about?
Lewis, we foresaw the problems we're facing today. In 2002, we knew that as a emerging international metropolis, diverse, the capital of the Americas, that we were only going to continue to grow. If we had traffic and mobility issues then, we knew we would have even more in the coming years. So what was presented to the voters was not some band-aid approach. It was a vision. It was a vision that included expansion of rail, increased bus services, improvements to our highways and streets, and a very important municipal component, which you've been seeing in the trolleys and things of that nature. But we also knew that in order to compete for federal monies, right, and state monies, you had to have what's called a local dedicated funding source. Without that money, it was impossible to compete. And that was the environment back then. Everybody understood that the money was going to other places. It was going to Boston. It was going to Denver. We needed to get a share of that money. But the PTP was very clear, as you mentioned, and that is that the new money was for new projects. And unfortunately, that's not what has been happening over the years.
In those first several years of the PTP, where was the money directed?
Well, for example, literally the day after the vote, provided free Metro Mover services for everybody. Metro Mover was free for everyone. We implemented the Golden Passport program, which was for all individuals over 65 to ride any one of our transportation modes for free. We extended portions of Metro Rail 24 hours. There were many buses that were increased 24 hours. In fact, when I leave the mayor's office 2 years later in November of 2004, we had added, Lewis, 8,600,000 additional revenue miles of bus service. Our ridership system-wide was up to 25%. I'm not suggesting we didn't have our kinks along the way. There were a lot of issues and mistakes we made in the rollout, but we were also embarked on the most ambitious expansion of public transportation anywhere.
So in 2009, I mean, we have the economic collapse. In the county votes that funding set aside for future transit projects could be used for existing infrastructure because, again, of the crisis. But you were no longer mayor at that time. But however, can you understand the need, though, at the time? Was it that right action to take then, or should we have just kept it as we had planned?
Lewis, of course I can understand the need, but you elect individuals to make difficult decisions, just like I made a difficult decision in 2002. It's not easy to go to the voters and tell them we need more of your money. Typically, politicians don't like to do that. So the reality is, yes, there was a recession. The leaders at that time had to tighten their belts and deal with a budget crisis, not simply use the half penny as basically a kitty jar, to balance the budget. And unfortunately, what you just mentioned, that unification of the budgets in 2009 has continued to date. And some estimates would suggest that up to $1 billion have been diverted from the People's Transportation Plan to subsidize existing services. And that's the frustration that not only I share, but many residents of this community.
If you were mayor, when would you have changed it back? When would you have started to, again, after the crisis, that had to be done, but when would you have changed it back or diverted the money back?
But Lewis, if I had been mayor, I would not have begun to do it that way. I mean, so there wouldn't have been a reverting back. Now, let's just say that there was some justification associated with the 2009 vote. Well, tax rolls have increased. The economy's improved. Property assessments are up. A lot more money is coming into the county coffers. Yet, in the pro forma that the mayor's presented to the TPO, he is still suggesting that we divert another $250 million over the next 5 years. And what I'm suggesting, because I like to also present solutions. I don't like to just come here and criticize. What I'm suggesting the TPO do tomorrow first is vote for rail as the people of South Dade were promised. Number two, I think they should send a very strong message like the CITT did. You just mentioned their resolution. In September, the county commission has to have the courage to cut off the subsidy to stop the bleeding. And a third step, I think, needs to be some sort of reimbursement, whether it's over a 30-year period or a 40-year period, where the general fund starts paying back the PTP for all this money that's been siphoned off over the years. If the TPO is presented tomorrow with that pro forma, there's going to be a lot more money available, not only for South Dade, but for transit corridors elsewhere in Dade County.
I'm talking with former Miami-Dade Mayor Alex Pinellas. Pinellas was mayor of the county from 1996 to 2004. He championed the People's Transit Plan, a half-cent tax intended to fund future transit options in the county. As we mentioned, tomorrow, Miami-Dade commissioners will vote about the future of public transit in South Miami-Dade. Is it bus rapid transit or expansion of Metro Rail? All right, let's talk about this Citizens Independent Transportation Trust. First of all, I mean, help us understand, what this trust is, what authority do they have?
Well, the intention, it was part of the ballot language in 2002. After we described what the program would be, the ballot language said, and shall be overseen, the scrutiny that would be provided would be by an independent transportation trust. Unfortunately, in those early days, the trust was not given the independence it needed. It was not given the independent staff that I think would have made their work even more worthwhile. And on top of that, unfortunately, they recommended the unification in 2009. But for the last 3 years, they have been asking the county to unwind the subsidy. What they did last week was say, listen, we're not going to ask anymore. We are actually going to demand that the county unwind this and stop the bleeding once and for all.
And if they do that, then what's going to happen to the price for rail and for maintenance moving forward?
Well, what's going to happen is, I agree, it will create a budget hole before the county commission in regards to their general fund subsidy of the transit department. But again, those are the difficult decisions, Lewis. Those are the difficult decisions I made as mayor for many years that I made in 2002. And what we've been seeing is the county's been kicking the can down the road. They've been delaying this decision. Now the unwinding is not going to happen until 2023. And it's that kind of bandage approach that's gotten us in the mess we are now.
And you know, you said that they've been asking or they've been mentioning for a few years, but why have they waited to this point to finally say, look, we're done with this. We're going to cut this off if you don't?
I think they bought into the argument that there needed to be a weaning off. And as part of that, the administration had agreed, for example, to complete the weaning off by 2020, but that deadline continues to get extended. Now it's 2023. So I think, quite frankly, they're fed up. But that's why they are a citizens independent transportation trust. As citizens, like I'm today a citizen, I'm fed up. I'm frustrated with the lack of progress with this initiative.
You're a champion of rail. You're a champion for
absolutely.
The
that was what was promised.
So how do you respond to the critics that say there's not enough ridership? We've seen ridership drop for the last few years.
That is a very myopic view. South Dade in particular is the one part of this county that will continue to grow. Every growth projection shows that South Dade will continue to grow over the years. When we drafted the PTP, we made rail for South Dade a priority four. What does that mean? It meant that it was towards the end of our 30-year plan. So the construction would have begun probably around 2020, 2025, because we knew there would be enough population. By sending more buses, by the way, I began the busway for South Dade when I was mayor in February of 1997. Forgive me for the history lesson,
that's
but
right,
it's
right.
It's necessary sometime. And then we extended it to Cutler Ridge in 2007. We've given buses to the people of South Dade. Now we should begin the process for rail, which will catch up to the population growth in the future years. That's how you plan for the future.
And in a very short period of time here, two things I want to squeeze in is one, okay, the more we keep kicking it down, the can down the line, it's going to get more expensive to build. I mean, at some point do we say, you know, it's just not going to happen? Because we also need federal dollars.
We also need federal dollars. When I left the mayor's office, though, by the way, I left the Arlington Heights to the airport extension fully funded without federal money. It was 100% local dedicated money and $100 million from the state. Obviously, we should apply for the federal money, but we also have to keep in mind not only the ridership projections for today, but what those ridership projections are going to be 8-10 years from now.
What's going to happen? What do you think is going to happen tomorrow?
Well, obviously, the administration is strongly recommending the BRT. What I would ask, even for those supporters of buses, what I would ask them to do is to have the courage and ask for a new pro forma, a new financial projection that zeroes out this continued subsidy of the operations with a half penny sales tax, and to plug in a new revenue stream, which would be a reimbursement or a repayment of the money that's been diverted. And look, put it over 20, 30 years. If they do that tomorrow, they will see a totally different financial picture.
Again, that vote's coming up tomorrow. We are going to be covering that story. I've been talking with former Miami-Dade Mayor Alex Pinellas. Again, he was mayor of the county when he championed, and when they passed the People's Transit Plan, that half-cent tax intended to fund future transit. What's going to happen? Is it going to be more rail, more buses? We're going to find out tomorrow. Mayor Pinellas, thanks so much. I really appreciate
it. It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I also want to mention, too, you can hear the interviews that we did with State Senator Keone McGee, Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez, and Chairman Esteban Vovo on tomorrow's vote on our website, WLRN.org. Find us again on social media, WLRN Sundial, and see what they said about this issue. Well, still to come, what if there was a place for artists they can go to learn how not to be starving artists? More on that coming up next here on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, there's a new program coming to Palm Beach County starting September 5th. The Mandel, Public Library, is opening up Studio 411. It's intended to cultivate new talent of artists. offering free resources. There will be studio series called Creative Entrepreneurs that will provide marketing, business, and professional growth mentorship for artists trying to make a living as an artist. That way you're not a starving artist. These classes, by the way, are going to be taught by professional artists. Now, the studio will also have paintbrushes, art software, and even a woodcutting machine for artistic adults to get their creative juices flowing. All of this free. Art craft instructor of the library and professional crafter Amanda Linton and Studio 411's director Joyce Pernicone join us now in studio. I really appreciate it. Amanda, Joyce, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having me.
Joyce, real quickly, I want to start with you. Help us understand the art scene in West Palm Beach. I mean, why was there a need to create this kind of space?
Well, we originally started like 4.5 years ago teaching classes to adults, and so we hired artists to do it. In working with those artists, we started realizing that what we needed to develop is an ecosystem of programs that not only benefited the people wanting to learn the art form, but also the artist that was teaching the classes.
How would you describe Studio 411? What's it going to look like, and what kind of stuff will artists have to work with?
Well, Studio 411 is like a door that opens to creativity, and it supports people just putting their feet in the water of the little creative pond, but it also supports the people that are deep, that are wading through. So you have art classes for the beginners, then for the artists, you have classes and you have equipment that they could use. A lot of the artistic equipment is very expensive. So here we provide the equipment and professional artists come and share that equipment. So it builds up that community.
And you have professional artists teaching these classes.
We have professional artists teaching, correct.
Because it's not just, it's my understanding too, is it's not just art classes like how to paint and things like that. We're talking about classes that help artists learn how to basically run their own business, because when you're an artist, you're kind of your own, you're an entrepreneur. You got to learn how to sell yourself.
Exactly. And we've partnered for that with ArtServe in Broward that has been doing those kinds of artist as an entrepreneur classes for 11 years now. And they partnered with an organization in Ohio to bring down, and as part of that partnership, in the fall, we're bringing down an instructor from New York that's coming down. So we have a high level of expertise. And most artists, they may be fabulous artists, but nobody ever teaches them how to earn a living with it. And here, not only are we offering those classes, but it's completely free of charge. So we're not taking any money away from the artist.
Again, because starving artists, they don't have any money to do that stuff. Amanda, you're an artist.
I am. I'm not starving.
All right, good. Well, that's good to know. But how would you describe it? Because you do a lot of different things. You're not just a painter or a sculptor. You do a lot of different things. You run your own little business.
I do. Yeah. Me and my husband actually have a real brick and mortar business that we run. So aside from teaching the classes at the library, I also do that full time.
And tell us a bit about what you do, though. Tell us a bit about your art.
Well, I always say I am a crafter. I love anything that I can get my hands into. And I always say my husband is the fine artist. He's the painter, drawing, all that kind of stuff. So basically anything that you can make 3D is what I love to do. I currently just started doing sterling silver jewelry. So.
And you know what? I mean, because you think about trying to make it as an artist. And look, I mentioned it before. I mean, I started college as an art major, and I just thought that one day I'd be the artist. But that also meant that you made friends, the right friends who hooked you up with the right friends who own galleries who could get you started, but they never taught classes on how to really, put yourself out there and do your own thing. How did you learn?
So I guess I did it backwards. I started events where I could sell my own art. So for the past 10 years or so through South Florida, I have created different arts, crafts, and vintage events where vendors can come and sell their arts. So I kind of built in a way for me to sell my art and give opportunities to hundreds of other artists along the way.
Again, I'm talking with arts crafts instructor and professional crafter Amanda Linton and Studio 411's director Joyce Pernicone. We are talking about a new arts incubator in Palm Beach County that's going to offer, again, not just art class, but business mentorship for new artistic professionals. It's really a whole lot more. It's not just painting classes. This is so much more than that. Joyce, one of the interesting things too is, like, for example, teaching the mechanics of accounting and bookkeeping. Again, this goes back to helping artists in really, you know, getting them out there and learning how to be organized. Because it's not, you have the left side, right? It's the left brain. I get this right. The left side of the brain, the artistic side. No, that's the right side. The left brain, you got to be more business minded. So that's really what you're trying to do, is help the artist go beyond just wanting to create.
Well, exactly. And many artists come with a misconception that if I'm really good at my art, then I will have no problem. People will see how stunning it is and I'll be on Easy Street. The problem is, it doesn't work that way. And a lot of it is strategy, and a lot of it is planning. And all of that does not necessarily come naturally to most artists unless it's taught. And we're able to teach this thanks to the West Palm Beach Library Foundation, the West Palm Beach Downtown Development Authority, the West Palm Beach Art and Entertainment District, the City of West Palm Beach Capital Improvement Plan, the administration of a library. So this is a huge team of people that are investing in the arts, and we're looking to really make a big difference.
And how would, if somebody right now is listening, is like, wait a second, this could be great for me. Where would they go? How would they get started? How could they be a part of that?
Well, we have our grand opening next Wednesday, September 5th at 4 o'clock, and that's going to be the ribbon cutting. And then right after that, at 6 o'clock, there's an orientation session, and Amanda will do a demonstration of the Cricut Maker, which is an amazing machine that artists could use to do all kinds of things. And we'll have several of these orientations. And they could just go on the library's website. There's an online calendar, and they could just, it starts on Wednesday, and there's literally something Wednesdays, Thursdays, Saturdays, so they could just look through the calendar and they'll find the time slots that they could make.
Amanda, hold on a second. Did I hear Cricut Maker?
It's a Cricut Maker.
Cricut Maker.
Yeah.
Please explain this to me.
So no crickets are involved. It is just a machine that has different blades. It can cut out different materials, fabrics, wood, vinyl. It's blowing my mind currently, so I highly recommend you guys stop by and check it out.
So you're going to be teaching classes.
Yep, I am. Yep.
What is it, I mean, you know, you think about the success that you and your husband have had. What is it you want to impart on artists as they are taking that next step for themselves?
That you can make a living doing your art. You just have to, like Joyce said, have two parts of that mind working at the same time. And I know as an artist, it's hard sometimes to bring those two together because I just want to be in my studio creating and making things. But you do have to have some knowledge of, okay, well, what do I do past that? And I'm really excited that this program is going to be brought to the library. I love teaching people any type of skills, whether it be business skills to help them sell their art or, you know, skills to actually make art to sell. So I'm very excited personally.
What do you tell somebody who's like, hey, listen, I'm not good at accounting and I'm not good at marketing and selling myself. I just want to create. I mean, what do you tell them? How do you get
have that? Just create, start there, create. And then, you know, there are people that will help you along the way. You know, you have to reach out to people. I need to take my own advice. I always try to do everything myself. But along the way, I've realized I do need an accountant. I do need a lawyer. I do need an assistant, a helper that can help me, you know, spend more time in my studio because she's doing things that I used to always do. So
it's good to have that extra knowledge.
For sure.
Joyce, again, real quickly, the opening, well, the big ceremony is next week on the 5th. Mm-hmm. And again, after that, just remind people, where can they go if they want, if they're interested in this, where can they go?
Well, the best place is to go online to the Mundell Public Library of West Palm Beach website and the online calendar. And there's all kinds of information and details. And we have several programs a week nonstop from September to December. So
check it out. We'll make sure we get a link up on our Facebook page so you could check that out as well. Again, talking with arts and craft instructor and professional crafter Amanda Linton, Studio 411's director Joyce Pernicone. Again, a new incubator for artists in Palm Beach County to help you out. Amanda Joyce, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
All right, and that's Sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. Remember to find us at WLRN.org. Find us on social media, Facebook or Twitter, at WLRN Sundial. We always love to hear from you. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.